This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today's guest is Evan Nierman. He is the crisis PR guru and mastermind behind the company Red Banyan, a world-renowned PR agency that always knows exactly what to say and when to say it. As the CEO and founder of this top-tier firm, Evan is a force to be reckoned with when it comes to delivering impactful messages to the right people at the right time. With two game-changing books under his belt, one on crisis communications and the other on cancel culture, Evan has nearly 30 years of experience in navigating high-pressure situations with grace and poise. Throughout his career, he has provided strategic communications counsel to top business leaders, government officials, and presidential candidates. His approach is simple: press the truth. When it comes to crisis communications, cancer culture, or celebrity PR. This is just a real fascinating discussion today. I can't believe how fast the hour went by. But it's just such a thing that we're all dealing with in our society today. This cancel culture is just crazy and scary and something that we see all the time and every day. What do we believe from media? What do we believe from people on social media? It's just something that we all have to be aware of and be careful with. And Evan does a great job in this conversation, kind of telling us what it's about and what to look forward to and what mistakes not to make. And if you do make a mistake, then what you can do about it. So I was just totally taken away by this conversation because it's so pertinent to what we deal with today, and I really enjoyed the discussion. I think you will as well. So let's just jump right in and get ready to have a really exciting and interesting conversation with Evan. Evan, welcome to the program today. I'm really excited to have you on.
I'm excited too. Thank you.
So now you're the CEO of Red Banyan. So share with us what that company is and what your role in that company is.
Yeah. Well, I'll take the second part of the question first. So my role in the company is I'm the founder and I'm the CEO. And so in terms of the CEO, for me, the most important thing that I spend my time doing is really nurturing the culture here. And so I'm involved with culture, making sure that the finances are in order, and maintaining high-level strategic relationships with our clients, with our partners, and really leading and outlining the vision for the company to my team of 30 who are spread out all across the country, working in every continental U.S. time zone, and some remotely, some from shared office spaces, and some from a larger office that we have in Fort Lauderdale in South Florida, where a number of us live and work. And what we do is we are in the business of strategic communications. And essentially what that entails is we work with clients, nonprofits, corporations, even sometimes individuals, and help them determine what their strategic outcomes are that they're aiming for, and then how to use communications in order to reach those objectives. And if I'm at a cocktail party or something, and people always want to talk about the crisis PR aspect, which I'm sure we'll get into at some point in this conversation. But when they ask me about Red Banyan, or they've read about one of our clients in the news or seen me quoted or something, they'll ask, what does Red Banyan do? And I'll say, well, we've really got two types of clients: those who want to get in the media and those who need to get the hell out.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it's just so out there in our culture, our society right now, and a lot of people making mistakes and a lot of people getting in trouble. So I'm sure you're sought after a lot. Now, a few years ago, you did a TEDx talk, and in that talk, you kind of brought up the concept is you know, you're not just telling the truth, but you have to sell the truth. So tell us what you mean by that, and what is the concept there?
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad you liked the talk, and thank you for referencing it. I'm actually super excited because I'm going to have the opportunity later this year. I think it's in November down in Dallas to give a new TED talk, which is going to be focused on the topic of cancel culture. But I'm excited for it. And, you know, my family actually lives nearby. They live in Dallas and some live in Louisiana. So they'll actually get to be there for it, which makes it particularly fun. The other talks that I've done, the TED talks, have been in remote locations, kind of far away. One was on the campus of Oracle out in California, outside of San Francisco. So that one, it'll be more fun to have my friends and my family there to hear it. And so the topic of, you know, I think the headline, the title of that TED talk was Never Tell the Truth. And at the time, I talked in that presentation about, you know, you can't tell the truth, you should sell the truth. Well, I since have modified that a little bit, slightly. It's the same overall meaning, but now I talk about it in the context of the importance of and the requirement to press the truth, which I think is actually a better thing. And in business, sometimes you start refining down. You get an idea and it's a decent one, and then you hone it a little more and it becomes a good one, then it gets slightly sharper. So the reason that I changed it from don't tell the truth, sell the truth, is, you know, sales has sometimes a little bit of a negative connotation to it. People think that people don't like to be sold, and it's salesy. It's kind of sleazy, oily, whereas press the truth, I like it because it's a double entendre. It's press as in you have to advance it. You have to move it forward. You have to present it, but then it's also refers to the press, the fifth estate, the media. So what we've adopted as really a mantra here at Red Banyan and impress upon our clients is you have to press the truth. And what that means is there was a time in the not too distant past where companies or individuals could afford to get hit with some bad press or to have people talking about them, and they didn't want to dignify those folks with a response. And so they would just stay out of the conversation, wait for the proverbial, you know, wave to crash, and then move on. And it was a lot easier to do that because there were newspapers, there was local television. And that was the way that people got their news primarily. And so there was a pretty good chance that if the person in their community didn't happen to read the newspaper or didn't see it on TV, no one would know about it. But in the age of the internet, that equation has changed completely. One thing happens and the whole world can know about it. There's nowhere to hide. And so what that means is for organizations, they have to be engaged like never before. They have to be willing to press the truth. They have to advocate for themselves. When calls come from reporters, they can't afford to no comment them or ignore them or wish them away. They've got to get engaged. They have to press the truth, because if they don't, the story is going to run regardless. And it's going to contain perhaps allegations, statements that are not completely true or maybe be completely untrue. But unless you're willing to press the truth, unless you're willing to be proactive, engaged, and to get in there and advocate for yourself and tell your story, no one else is going to tell it for you. So that's really what press the truth is. And I'm a big believer that every organization, small, medium, and large, every single industry is under more pressure now than at any time in our lifetimes to press the truth.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because I think what you're saying there is the, you know, the conventional wisdom of the past was, well, just ignore it. Don't honor them by, you know, saying it's true, untrue, just kind of hide in the weeds and it'll go away and move on. But what you're saying now is you just can't do that because you're just going to get buried.
Yeah, buried. I think buried is a good, that's a good analogy. I like to use the analogy of, I view it as like a turtle crossing a highway. And especially if we're talking, I mean, this, we're really having a conversation about any topic that impacts an organization, their bottom line, their revenue, their reputation. But this becomes even more true when you're talking about something perhaps unpleasant or controversial related to a brand. And if you go with the turtle approach, which is there's a turtle, he's sauntering, moseying very slowly across the highway, and all of a sudden, this threat of an 18-wheeler is hauling butt down the highway, headed right for the turtle. And in this analogy, that is the bad news, the story that they don't want to come out, the mistake that somebody made. If you become a turtle as an organization and you freeze up and you suck yourself into your shell, that truck's still coming. And what's going to happen is it's going to crush you. And that's what organizations find if they're not willing to engage, if they're not willing to press the truth, if they either sit back and do nothing or they get stuck with analysis paralysis and they're in boardrooms endlessly debating, should we do this? Should we do that? And if they don't have someone on their team, either inside or an outside consultant or whomever, an expert who deals with these types of things to advise them and force them to actually catalyze into action, it can become a very dangerous situation for them.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, I work with my clients a lot, and I kind of feel like, you know, I use the term storytelling, and that, you know, often great leaders are great storytellers. And you do mention that, you know, storytelling with brand building is a very important thing.
Storytelling is vital. And the better a person, the better an organization is at telling stories, the more successful they're going to be on multiple fronts. It's telling the story of your business, your company, your vision, your department, your project, your endeavor. That's what gets your team motivated. It's what gets the potential customers excited. It creates a resonance with them. It also attracts people who want to work for your organization because they like your story. So storytelling is vital, and it's a really important skill that every organization has a story. They're not all good at telling it, but they all should.
And do you think that you can teach storytelling? Can you teach somebody to be a good storyteller?
Of course you can. Absolutely. It's like any other skill. It's learned. Now, there are some people who have a natural ability to storytell better than other people. But it's something that absolutely can be taught. And so I think of it on a sliding scale of 1 to 10. Maybe someone is just an absolute horrible presenter. They've got poor delivery. They never alter the range, the volume. They just kind of drone on monotone. Maybe they just use long words that no one understands. There's any one of a number of things that could make them relatively bad or poor as a storyteller. But with coaching and with advice and with dedication to getting better, they can absolutely. So someone who's a one or a two, which is pretty rare, but that's, you know, we're being dramatic here. Someone who's a one or a two can work on this and probably get themselves up eventually to a six, a seven, an eight. Now, are they going to become a 10? Almost certainly not. But there are loads of people who are decent storytellers. Maybe they've never been trained in it. Maybe they've never practiced it. They've never refined the skill. They start out as a five or six. There's no reason those people can't become masters of storytelling.
Yeah, that's great. You know, people, you know, the messages that come out from, you know, whether it's companies or politicians or whatever, I mean, it's just, these days, it's just so hard to believe some of these messages. And with so much, you know, lying and misinformation going on or whatever, you know, who can they trust? Are people just learned to be very skeptical of the message? Or do you think that people really want to hear that and resonate with that?
People have to be skeptical because we're forced to be, because unfortunately there is so much deception and there's so much misinformation and even disinformation where people are purposefully trying to pull the wool over your eyes, and they're trying to tell you things that are not true, make you accept lies, or at least muddy the waters where you don't know who to believe or what to believe. I think it's a really dangerous place for us. And I think there's no doubt that it's gotten much, much more of a problem over the last decade and even within more recent years. I think the barometer of trust studies show that people don't trust corporations. They have even lower trust when it comes to politicians and Congress. And so it makes it, and now also the media. And make no mistake about it, this isn't a right wing, a left wing. This is a nonpartisan argument that I'm making. But I believe that there has been an assault on truth, and there has been an assault on the media in recent years. Yes, the media deserves to be critiqued. Yes, there are many times when reporters have agendas where they don't behave in ethical ways. But there has been a discrediting of the press to such an extent that I do believe it has eroded public trust in an institution that plays a very, very important function in our society. I don't think that that's a good thing, because we do need an active and engaged media in order to hold people to account and in order to provide information that people need to go about their lives. But there is no doubt in my mind that there's been a massive erosion in trust, and that some of that has been because people have talked so much about how nothing the media says can be trusted.
You know, it's so interesting. I'm sure you're familiar with the international company called Edelman. And they do this study every year where it's kind of like they call it their like trust barometer, and who do people trust, and where do they get their information that they can, you know, latch onto. And, you know, as you said, a decade ago or so, it might have been, the media, it might have been church, it might have been, trusted politician or whatever, and all those things have kind of gone away. And so now a lot of people are getting their information and trusting information from the company they work for, which puts a whole different importance on messages we're giving to the people that work for us, and information that we're giving, where, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, if you would have said, "Oh, I trust everything my corporation tells me," you'd get laughed out of the room. So it seems like that's right. Really changed.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I was, you know, I know Edelman quite well. They're a global PR behemoth, a juggernaut, and they as far as the biggest agencies go, I actually think Edelman, in many cases, I know a number of people who work at Edelman, and I actually hold the company in pretty high esteem in terms of massive international PR conglomerates. And I think it's so interesting what you said about the degree to which people now increasingly trust their employer. I actually think that the internal audience, the team member, the employee, that is often the audience that gets most neglected and is almost treated as an afterthought in many cases, which it shouldn't be. And that's particularly what happens when you start talking about this niche of high stakes and crisis communication, where my firm Red Banyan really specializes. Because what you find is many times clients will call you in and they are so fixated on wanting to press the truth to the press, to the media, to an external audience, to the customers. But what they oftentimes forget is they're missing that delivery of the message to those who really matter the most, which are their internal team members. Why? One, because to your point, they're going to be inclined perhaps more than anyone else to trust their employer, because at the end of the day, they're getting a paycheck from them, they're providing a livelihood to their families, they've got connections, relationships, colleagues who they like, who they trust, who they see every day at work. They really know the culture. And what people also can do who work for the company is they can then be amplifiers, brand advocates. If you spend the time to both brief your team on about what's going on in the company, and if you're telling stories on an ongoing basis about what the company is, what the company believes in, what you're focused on. If the founder or the CEO or the senior management really does a good job of focusing on storytelling and communicating effectively within an internal audience, it then gets magnified exponentially because all of those people are on the phone, they're on the computer, they're interacting with droves and droves of people in their day-to-day lives, and then also online, where you have an audience in today's world that's virtually limitless. A message that you need to send, if you tell five people who are inside your company, they can go online and they could put something out there and it could potentially be received by millions, hundreds of millions, or even billions of people. And that's an amazing thing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about this cancel culture world that we live in. You know, how do you avoid getting caught in this predicament, and how do you get out of it if something horrible happens?
Yeah, well, it's a complex question. There's a lot of levels to it. There's so much there that I actually wrote an entire book about it called The Cancel Culture Curse, which people can check out. It's available everywhere. You can go to cancelculture.com and learn more about some of the core tenets. But the key, there are a couple of really key things to keep in mind when it comes to cancel culture and not getting canceled. And one is the best way to prevent getting canceled is to be cautious about what you do online. Because as I was just describing in answer to your last question, there's a limitless audience of people. The internet never sleeps. There's always someone listening. So actually my very first TED Talk, How We Risk Our Lives Online, I focused on two pieces of advice that will prevent not all instances of cancel culture, but it will prevent an awful lot of them. And that is, before you post something online, share with care and post with purpose. Share with care means be careful about what you're putting out there in the world. Make sure you're not revealing your physical location. Don't tell people in real time that you're out of town and you're in the Florida Keys if you live in Seattle, because then you're also letting people know, hey, my house in Seattle is wide open. No one's home. We're away. So when you think about sharing with care, that's an example where you don't want to open yourself up to risk. Now, post with purpose, that's really where most people fall down and what ends up getting them canceled. So before you go to post something online, whether it's Threads, Twitter/X, Instagram, you name it, Snapchat even, it doesn't matter. It's whatever platform you're accessing. Think about what you're putting out into the world. Is there really a benefit to you saying what you're about to say or sharing that content that you're about to share? Or does it put you at risk? Is it something that makes the world better? Or is it something that you would be embarrassed if a critical mass of people saw? Are you reacting to something with anger, speaking, using very strident language? Are you using any racial slurs? Are you insulting someone? When people start to do that, they're reacting quickly in the moment. They are not posting with purpose. And many, many times it's that content that gets out there into the world, which someone stumbles upon and then amplifies. And then next thing you know, you got a real big problem and you have a mob of people coming after you, trying to hurt you, called cancel vultures.
Yeah, it's just so, and you describing that, I'm just thinking of things like, well, first of all, you know, do companies need a filter or a committee or something to look at messages before they go out, which may be, prudent. But on the other hand, then things get very canned, you know, and they're not authentic, or they're not as, on the moment. But yet, with what could happen, maybe that's a good strategy. Or do you think, I guess the other question is, should companies embrace social media or should they try and stay away from it?
You have to find the sweet spot when it comes to your social media. You use the word authentic, and authentic is really the secret sauce. That's why some people end up having their posts really resonate. The companies that have lots of canned, stale, boring, really non-inspiring content are the ones that are really checking the box of being active on social media, but they're not building audiences, they're not building rapport, they're not increasing their followers, etc. What's amazing is most companies have very few safeguards in place when it comes to social media. And they may have a handful of people who have access to the accounts, which limits accountability, by the way, because let's just make up a company and or pick a company and let's just use Starbucks as an example. Say Starbucks has 10 people who have access to the Facebook page of Starbucks. Well, then if somebody posts something and it doesn't land well with the audience that's out there and it sparks controversy, well, it's very hard to tell which of the 10 actually posted it because we got so many different people and they all have access. So companies would do well to limit the number of people who have access just to increase accountability. The other thing is so many companies, they don't think strategically about how they're going to deliver their social media content. And so what they do is they actually give the keys to the kingdom to what's typically the youngest, most inexperienced person in the company, because the 22-year-old who just graduated college grew up with a smartphone and grew up with an internet connection always, and is typically much more internet savvy, lives and breathes and every day on social media. And so what you end up doing, ironically, is you take the person, I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm in my mid-40s. So on the one hand, young enough to still be with the times, but on the other, the decades of life and experience and professional growth, they afford you a certain amount of wisdom. And that comes with age and experience. The problem is if you have someone who's in charge of your social media, controlling your message, controlling your voice, speaking on behalf of a company with thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of lives, livelihoods at risk, you got to be really, it just makes no sense that you would put so much into the hands of such an inexperienced group of people. And so I do think that companies would do well to look at who has access. I think the companies that do it right, they do have multiple levels of editing just to make sure, to be careful, to dot the I's and cross the T's and make sure that what they're putting out on social media is engaging and it's interesting. And every once in a while, they can even dip their toe in the water in terms of being edgy, but you can't afford to be offensive or to be tone deaf or to create a problem. And again, that comes from having experience and judgment. And sometimes it's good to have more than one set of eyes on a post before it goes live.
That makes a lot of sense. And is there a difference? I'm struggling with the word, like I'm thinking of censorship. So, you know, censorship in our messages or what we can do, is that growing in the world today in businesses? Or is that different than this cancel culture? Are they the same or are they different?
I think there is an increase in censorship. You know, censorship is not necessarily the same thing as cancel culture per se, but what cancel culture has led to is individuals self-censoring or looking to censor other people whose views they have an issue with. And so one of the byproducts of living in an age of cancel culture, and when it comes to cancel culture, you're talking about a disproportionate response to an alleged transgression that's carried out against someone. So you can do or say something which doesn't land well with a critical mass of people, and then they get together and they gang up on you. And in a form of online bullying, they look to cancel you. They look to get you fired. They look for you to be publicly scorned, shamed, and rendered radioactive for the rest of your life. And the problem is with that is that every single one of us who walks this planet makes mistakes. We all have done things and said things that if we had to do it over again, maybe we would have done a little bit differently. But the problem with cancel culture is it removes the ability of people to ever be forgiven and then to be redeemed. And that's a really dangerous thing for our society. It's a standard to which we shouldn't be holding anyone, because at the end of the day, if we permit it to continue and we let other people cancel other people, who's to say our own day won't come? And eventually there'll be no one left to cancel because we'll all have canceled each other. And that's why I'm a big believer that, you know, we have to preserve these American ideals of free speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and also due process. And that's an element that I think a lot of people forget about when it comes to cancel culture. We don't talk about due process. And due process is something that guarantees if you're accused of a crime, you have an opportunity. One, you have a presumption of innocence under the law. And then there's a process that that you undergo where you have a chance to go before a jury. These people are required to come in with an open mind, not to have prejudged your guilt or your innocence. You're afforded a chance to tell your side. The other side gets their chance to present their case. And in the end, the people who came in with open minds get to decide. But when it comes to cancel culture, the complete opposite is what happens. There's a group of people who come in predisposed to believe one thing or another. They don't assume innocence. In fact, they presume that you're guilty of whatever the accusation is against you. And then they don't wait for the information to be presented in a fair setting. They simply seize on whatever nugget of information is out there, some of it true, some of it not true. And then they just tar and feather you, they convict you, and they sentence you and punish you for life, even before you've had a chance to advocate for yourself. And I think that that's very, very dangerous. And frankly, that's why I wrote this book, is because I was tired of counseling people whose lives were disrupted, their careers destroyed, because groups of fellow citizens decided that they had done something so terrible, accused them of some dastardly crime, whether they'd done it or not, and then intimidated them, scorned them, punished them, and hurt them. And I just don't think that that's the way that we should be treating one another.
It's a scary world for sure. And you mentioned you're in your mid-40s, and I think you have children. So my children are adults, so I don't have that same fear. But are you scared to death for them as they wade into this world of social media and get their own smartphones? That's got to be just horrifying as a parent with the knowledge you have.
It's very scary. And, you know, I talk to my kids all the time. They understand what I do for a living. They know that a lot of the work that I do is helping people who get into bad circumstances, good people in challenging circumstances. But I think it's really every parent's responsibility to have conversations with their kids about fundamental things like internet safety. And again, like not communicating with strangers, not revealing their location, certain basic best practices to keep their kids safe. I think younger kids absolutely should be monitored by their parents and the exposure to websites and to certain content curbed. There's all sorts of software solutions to that, apps in order to help the parents. Can even use your own smartphone to control whether or not your kids have access to the internet during certain hours or control screen time. It's really, really important. And another thing is parents have to teach kids about what they can believe and not believe on the internet and become more discerning consumers of information. Because guess what? Not everything you read online is true. And the same way that we don't want people to rush to judgment against us or about us, we shouldn't rush to judgment about other people either. Kids don't know these things instinctively. You're not born being able to determine what's the difference between a highly credible news site that has editors and an editorial process versus some blog that a guy is writing. Or maybe it's, you know, somebody who's just using AI and ChatGPT to produce content and then post it to the web. So we're going to have a whole generation of young people who we have to invest time and effort in educating them about how to become more savvy users of online content.
Absolutely. You know, there appears to be just a real gap between you know, behaviors of people online versus in person, you know, what people are willing to say and do and whatever, you know, online is very different than if you were face to face with somebody.
100%. And you see that every day. People do and say things online when they think they're being anonymous. And in some cases, when they're not even being anonymous, they've got their name or their screen name or their identity actually known to the world, but they conduct themselves very, very differently online versus how they behave in real life. And part of the reason why cancel culture has taken such hold and it's landed so many people in hot water is there's an endless number of people who will do things online because it's easy, quick, simple, perhaps anonymous, that they would never do in real life. So it's very easy, for instance, to hear about someone who's accused of doing something and then fire off an email or click on a petition in order to demand that that person be fired. Keep in mind, you don't actually know that person personally in most cases. You're reacting to whatever information you've consumed online about him or her. But you don't actually really know what that person's like, their moral compass or lack thereof. And so it's very simple to become a keyboard warrior who dedicates yourself to crusading against other people if you don't have to look that person in the eye. You don't have to understand that this is a person who's trying to go about their life. They're imperfect, but you know, they're trying to do the best they can. Maybe they have several kids at home that they're trying to take care of. And so if they make a mistake, if you knew somebody who was your neighbor and you knew that they made a mistake and you saw them every day loading up the minivan and taking the kids to karate and to dance class, maybe you'd hesitate before you'd go meet with someone, their boss, their employer, and say, this is a terrible person. They should be fired immediately. And then that person's not able to provide for their family. It's a much different thing when you read about someone online. You don't really take into account their humanity, and it's just all too easy to pile on, to make a terrible comment about them on social media, to join a petition, to call for them to be held to account in some draconian way. And people definitely do not behave in real life the way that they do in online life.
Yeah, it's just overwhelming at times. You know, someone who has a large following, and okay, we won't name names here, but someone who can totally destroy reputations or worse, put people at risk of harm. You know, if they criticize that person, how do you stop a bully who uses that tactic and just goes after somebody relentlessly?
It's very hard, and unfortunately, the age of the internet has produced a bully pulpit for everyday citizens in some cases, or people who actually have no qualifications to talk about the issues about which they talk, but yet they have a truly staggering number of people, call them followers, contacts, etc., who are part of their audience, who will imbibe their message and then sometimes feel spurred to action by these people. So influencers have tremendous influence, hence the name, and they can have an outsized effect when it comes to both bolstering or burning down reputations. So it's very hard. If someone is notorious as an online bully, and this is many times you ask why. Why would someone behave in that way? And why would someone participate in a cancel culture takedown? And the answer is many times to get attention, because the bigger your audience, the bigger the following, the more opportunities you have to monetize your audience, to get sponsorships, to make money on videos that you post, etc. And if you're controversial and you're quick to come up with something that goes viral, you're increasing the eyeballs on your posts. You're making yourself known to perhaps new audience members. You're expanding. And so unfortunately, it's oftentimes negativity that attracts more than positivity. And so that's how you end up in these circumstances where people will say crazy things, or they'll say rude things to other people, and they're doing it because they want to break through all the people who are putting their voice out there, and they want to be held up as breaking through the clutter and getting attention and getting clicks and likes. And ultimately it's about getting attention and monetizing.
And power is a drug. And when you've, you know, an insignificant one person in the world has power to do that, you know, I can see people getting taken away with that.
That's a great point. And I've seen it happen in many instances of cancel culture. Someone who doesn't really have a lot of power in their day-to-day life, they're just, you know, an average person doing their thing. But all of a sudden, if they can participate in something controversial and they can feel like they got involved and they took a stand on an issue and they crushed someone, they got that guy fired. I saw recently in a very clear-cut case of cancel culture, someone got actually it was Jason Aldean, the country singer, who he had a video that came out. People said very negative things about it, and a campaign was waged that went after Country Music Television and urged CMT to take down the video. And I saw tweets online. I can still call them tweets because they hadn't rebranded to X yet. I saw tweets where someone was saying, I feel so humbled and proud to have been a small part of our effort to get this horrible video taken down by CMT. So the person felt like they had done God's work. They were on a mission, and that they accomplished something to the detriment of Jason Aldean and all the people who might have wanted to actually see his video. So I agree with you. There is a sense of the internet is the great equalizer, because we all have access to the same tools. We don't all have the same followings, but people have the same tools and the same access. And it does give an opportunity for people who were previously or currently powerless in many ways to become very powerful.
And then on the other end, I mean, you know, as you said earlier, we all make mistakes. And the forgiveness apology response just seems to be something that is declining in our society. I mean, you know, to go forward and say, hey, look, I screwed up. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. I'm willing to own my behavior. This is what I'm going to do going forward. And that used to mean something. I'm not sure it does as much today.
I agree. It doesn't. But here's the double-edged sword and the irony here. So on the one hand, you should be able to say that if someone makes a mistake, there is value in them owning it, apologizing. They used to talk about, you know, in the, sort of the rules of crisis management, where if you foul up, then you fess up, and then you start to fix it up. And now cancel culture has changed fundamentally this equation, where someone makes a mistake, accepts responsibility or accountability, and then is forgiven and then able to move on. Cancel culture completely demolishes that, because in a cancel culture world, I'm accused of doing something, whether I did make a mistake or not. But let's assume that I did make a mistake and I genuinely regret it. And then I issue a public apology having done something offensive. And whereas in the past, it would have been, okay, well, now we forgive and then we move on. Well, in a cancel culture world, the second that you apologize, the cancel vultures swoop down and they go, see, I told you. He's acknowledging what he did was wrong. He's admitting he's a bad person. Therefore, that person never deserves to be on a stage again. We should take that person down. Let's cancel them. And that's just madness, because it's through experiences in life where we make mistakes that we oftentimes experience the greatest growth. I actually really believe you learn far more from your mistakes than you do your successes. And unfortunately, the apology has become a double-edged sword. People feel like they have to rush to apologize. And if you'd asked me 5 years ago, 7 years ago, before cancel culture became a thing, I would tell you as a crisis manager, the default move would be, oh yeah, well, let's apologize, because we're going to be able to move on. In this day and age, the advice that I would give is not necessarily apologize. In fact, I would say you only apologize in circumstances where, one, an apology is warranted. truly warranted. And two, when you can clearly identify who that person is who deserves your apology. Because if you're making these hostage apologies where you're apologizing because you're just trying to get the mob to back down, or you're doing it because you're forced to do so, they don't seem authentic and it doesn't really accomplish anything. And how do you apologize to a mob of people who want to take you down, to whom you actually haven't committed any sort of personal affront? It's very challenging.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's for sure. Let's make it, would you be willing to go over a few case studies of people that maybe we've seen in the news and the media that have gone through this, and maybe things that they could have done better or whatever, just to give this a little context?
Sure.
Let's go over a few, you know, case studies. You know, I have a few in mind, but you probably have better ones. So is there something that comes to mind that you could share with us?
No, let's hear yours, and I'll just tell you if I don't know enough about the case, then I'll ask you for a different one. But
okay, well, the one that
ones that I have no knowledge of.
Okay, the one that comes to mind is the African American birder in Central Park who asked the woman to put her dog on a leash in a part of the park that required a leash. And she took offense to that, and then it became this altercation and so on. And so that was a situation that just blew up. And you may have your opinion on which side, you know, you're on, but I think there were some mistakes made on her part that maybe could have made that better. Is that true, or what's your feeling on that?
So I'm extremely familiar with this case, and this is a classic case of cancel culture. I actually know a lot about this circumstance. And when it took place, as is often the case with cancel culture, the retribution was swift. So the person who you're talking about, this woman, Amy Cooper, who was caught on video, she was branded a racist. And I know for a fact she had to leave her apartment in the dead of night when a gang of people were coming to her apartment building, because people figured out who she was. She was doxxed. And so that means they were sharing her personal details online. And when the video went viral, the building told her that they couldn't guarantee her safety, and she had to slip out, hidden, to escape a mob of people who came to seeking, in their minds, justice against this woman who they had branded the Central Park Karen. And since that time, that person was then fired from her job, and the company released the statement that basically said, you know, we don't condone racism, and we expect a certain level of conduct from our employees. And so while they didn't explicitly call her racist, they basically, you know, they released a statement about her, and it referred to racial discrimination, racism. So I think the implication is pretty clear. There were a lot of facts about what actually took place that the media glossed over. They came out later with in-depth reporting. Barry Weiss on her podcast got into this topic some. There were several other folks who really did a good job of articulating what happened. Camille Foster is someone who really, I think, did a good job of encouraging the world to look with more of a critical eye on this case, because what was presented to the public was an African-American man tells this lady to put her dog on the leash because he's birding. She freaks out. She tells him she's going to call the police, and she's going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening me. Implication being, you know, she's going to use race as a way to target him because he asked her to put the dog on the leash. And it's a video that paints a woman in a very bad light. She looks frenetic. She's holding onto her dog's collar. The dog is squirming. She's shrill. She's freaked out. Now, we now know what we saw in the video doesn't actually tell the whole story. The individual came upon this woman in the park. It was just the two of them. She was out there. He physically, much more imposing person than her. She's all alone in a fairly desolate part of the park. He immediately starts screaming at her. So her amygdala gets triggered. She's got the fight or flight going. She's scared. And he starts yelling at her. And the other thing that we found out that he did was he starts telling her, put your dog on a leash. She says, I don't have to. I let my dog run here. And he tells her, if you're going to do what you're going to do, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And you're not going to like it, which is a pretty ominous and threatening phrase. I don't know exactly what he meant by that. But then he did start calling her dog over to him and starts taking a bag of something out of his backpack, which is when she grabs the dog, etc. So it was not so cut and dried that she was targeting him. And I think it was painted that this poor guy was the victim of racial profiling and abuse and a threat to call the cops on him. This guy recorded the video. He put it out there. But it was not exactly what happened there was not all of the context that I think people would need in order to really understand that circumstance. That to me is a perfect example of the danger of cancel culture, because the media jumped on the story, they amplified it, they spread it all over the world, and that woman literally had to run for her life. And did she deserve criticism for how she handled herself? Maybe, but did she deserve to be fired and forced to flee and live in hiding and fear? I doubt that.
Well, in interviews afterwards, the gentleman even said that he was pushed hard to press charges and take this further and, you know, do this for all the things that have happened in the past, you know, and he just said, look, you know, she suffered way beyond the circumstance. In other words, you know, the punishment did not really match the crime. So he said, no, I'm not going to do that. She suffered enough, and that's not something that I'm interested in doing. So even he felt that was just blown way too far.
Yeah,
that's an interesting story. Well, now you said earlier that you an author, you're a two-time author from what I understand. So your most recent book, as you said, is The Cancel Culture Curse, From Rage to Redemption in a World Gone Mad, and that's just been out this year. And then you had a previous book called Crisis Averted, PR Strategies to Protect Your Reputation and Bottom Line, and that was released in 2021. So I would imagine the response to those books are pretty good.
Yeah, it's been great. It's enabled me to connect with readers from all around the world. People have reached out to me. You know, the first book I thought was really important to write because I wanted to talk about an area of communications that's often misunderstood. And frankly, I got tired of people always asking me, hey, tell me about the craziest thing that you ever had to work on. I was like, eventually I figured if I write it down in a book, then the next time someone tells me that, I'll just say, oh yeah, I've got a bunch of them. Just read it in the book. And then I don't have to go over the same anecdotes, worn out ones over and over again. This new book, The Cancel Culture Curse, I felt compelled to write this one. This one is one that I've seen firsthand the devastation of people's personal lives. And I wrote this book in the hopes that it will make some small contribution toward people thinking twice before they cancel someone else, and other people can maybe avoid some of the steps that could get them canceled. So, you know, both of them are book writing books is a labor of love. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, but I think at the end of the day, you know, I still believe that it's important for people to read books and to express ideas in a longer form, even though a lot of people don't have the attention beyond, you know, used to be 140, 280 characters, et cetera. But I read a ton of books. It's where I encounter all sorts of ideas and nuggets of inspiration. And I hope that there are people out there who will get some nuggets or some inspiration from my books too.
Yeah. You know, you make a good point. I've had people say, well, you know, I like your podcast, but they're kind of long, you know, but to me, sometimes it takes that a little bit more time to get down to the deep issues and understand it in a deeper way. You can't do it in 10 or 15 minutes, you know? So
you can't, not if you want to get into a real discussion and context and consider things with any sort of depth of thought.
Yeah. So in anticipation of our discussion today, is there anything that I haven't asked you or we haven't covered that you want to be sure you get into the program?
No, I really appreciated the opportunity to come on. I actually love the length of this discussion, and we were able to cover so much ground and so many different topics. So I just want to express my appreciation to you for having me on and asking such interesting questions.
Well, thank you. And usually at this time in the interview, I always ask my guests the same common question. And that question is, in relation to leadership, what is a pearl of wisdom that you could leave us with today?
You got to press the truth. Of course, what else could it have been? If you're a leader, people want to be inspired. The leader has to articulate a vision, and you got to get your story out there. And no one's going to do it if you're not willing to do it. So every day, press the truth.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, Evan, this has been a real pleasure. The topic is fascinating. I think it's something that is so needed. And gosh, I'm just hearing you talk, and it's interesting, but it's scary. And it's like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? But, we have to address these things. As you said earlier, we just can't, hide our head in the sand and ignore them and hope they go away. So people like you that are doing the hard work in this area, I appreciate that. And it's great to hear your take on it and what we can do and what we can try and avoid. And it's just really good information. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, well, happy to do it. And if it helps one person, coming on your podcast helps one person today, it was well worth you and I chatting for an hour.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it. And have a good rest of your day. And we'll see you down the road.
Okay, you as well. Don't forget to press the truth. Take care.
Okay, thanks, Evan. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.